Today is the eighth program in our 2026 spring lineup. As a reminder, our plan is to go until 7:30. That's after presentations and a Q&A as well. After the Q&A is done, if you want to linger and talk with any of our panelists, I'm sure they'd be happy to linger themselves. We are deeply grateful for the longstanding support from our community, ensuring that we provide quality programming on international issues for over 42 years here in the Iowa City community. We wouldn't be here without you. Thank you. Thank you for your donations in the past and any donations you would have in the future. I want to tell you about our next program. This is special. Please plan on joining us on Thursday, the 7th of May in the evening for our last of the season. We're going to have Resisting Global Tyranny series. For the first time, the Foreign Relations Council will be at the Englert Theater. This is titled The Blind Spot, How Oligarchs Dominate Our Democracy. In this discussion, political science Jeffrey Winters, with the public radio host Ben Kiefer, is going to deliver an urgent, incisive account of how we reach this era of in-your-face oligarchy, exposing how modern democracy was developed to protect the interests of the ultra-rich, by tracing the evolution of oligarchy across the globe and through modern history. He will demonstrate how the rule of the wealthy isn't just a flaw in our democracy, it has been built into our very foundations. Now, in an extraordinary paradox, we exist in a state of participatory inequality, a world in which 99.99% of us participate openly and freely, democratically even, in our own ongoing exclusion and disenfranchisement. There's more information on your tables and also on our website, especially with what went on in Hungary this past couple of weeks. I think this is especially going to be topical. And Ben Kiefer, you know, he has a radio show. Just to kind of let you know, he'll be there as well. Let's turn to tonight's program. We would like to give a heartfelt thank you to our partners, the Iowa City Public Library, Proteus Incorporated, and the UI International Programs Office and the UI Global Health Network, who provided the food today. For their speakers, I'm going to have the three locals present themselves, but I would like to welcome our special guests, especially because I worked on the pronunciation. We'll see how I do, Vanessa. Dr. Vanessa Govender is a South African specialist in occupational medicine with her 30 years of experience across clinical practice, public health, academia, and consulting, in particular expertise in mining health, occupational lung diseases, and health risk policy strategy and communication. She is the director of the Masakani Strategic Health Consulting Limited, an advisor to the Shimizu Trust, South Africa's enhanced compensation system for former gold mine workers, and an honorary lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand School of Public Health, where she completed her medical and postgraduate training. Her work focuses on the prevention and diagnosis of dust-related lung disease, the translation of global classification systems into practice, and the responsible integration of artificial intelligence into occupational health systems. That's modern thinking. She is an author of From Suspicion to Submission, Occupational Lung Diseases in the South African Mining Industry, a Harvard Medical School AI and Healthcare Programmatic Finalist, a guest lecturer with the International Labor Organization, and a collaborator on international research examining early biomarkers of silicosis. So, Dr. Bedal, I'll have you start, and please introduce yourselves.
All right. Yeah, I'm David Bedal. I'm a local. I was born here, and then I'm in family medicine. I have an interest in global health. Since I've been back in Iowa, I've been doing immigration health. I worked down in Lone Tree and now in Riverside. Because I worked for 8 years in El Salvador, speak Spanish, so I have probably 40 to 50% of my patients are Spanish speakers. So I see a lot of people from the meatpacking industry, see people that work as farm workers, and I've done some teaching in global health in places like Niger in Africa, Venezuela. My time overseas as a volunteer was in El Salvador. And then with Rick, or with the same program as Rick, I spent some time in Russia.
Hi, everyone. My name is Naomi Marroquin. I am the healthcare team lead for Proteus Incorporated. I'm actually from the Des Moines office now, but I worked for the last 5 years or so here in Iowa City, and then just moved to Des Moines back in June. And then for those of you that don't know what Proteus is, we're a local nonprofit. Our headquarters is in Des Moines, but we have offices in Iowa City and Fort Dodge. And we serve agricultural workers and reprocessing workers with healthcare access and needs. We do a lot of mobile clinics throughout the state, and I'm excited to connect with y'all.
Thank you, Naomi. I'm Claudia Corwin. I'm with the University of Iowa. I'm a surgeon. I'm a bit of a chameleon. I'm a surgeon, occupational medicine doc. My focus is on working more vulnerable, but I have to say also very resilient working populations, and a bit of a focus in global health, and I am the director of the Iowa Global Health Network. Happy to be here. So Dr. Govender is going to begin her presentation, and as she goes to the podium, I'll say that during this panel discussion, we're going to kind of explore the nexus between sort of the South African mining experience, occupational and health experience, and migrant seasonal farm workers and meatpacking workers here in Iowa. And also see if we can explore the nexus between public health and worker experience, and sort of begin to deconstruct in our minds those silos, those things that are often siloed apart from each other. So with that, we will begin with Dr. Govender. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Claudia. And thank you very much for those kind words. Very well pronounced, Rick. Thanks very much. Yeah, it's wonderful to be here, and thank you all for making time out in your diaries and this beautiful spring day in Iowa City. My topic today is really one that's extremely close to my heart, and something I think that one evolves with, you know, as our careers progress, and we start to think more and more about, especially in medicine, on how we can prevent some of the many diseases that we've spent all our careers diagnosing. And I think there's a strong focus on the prevention of non-communicable diseases, of occupational diseases, and especially when these diseases can be prevented. And we know that the exposures can be controlled in the workplaces, but yet we are still diagnosing them. And that is a challenge that we carry with us as occupational medicine physicians. So I must say, when I walked into this library, it gave me such joy because I love libraries. And back home in South Africa, many of the libraries are actually closing down because people are taking to online reading. We had one of our major, very beautiful old buildings that had to be shut down. I'm not sure what they did with the books, but hopefully they've donated it to people who will find it useful. But I think holding a book and seeing the enthusiasm, I actually wandered into the main library when I got here, is really so encouraging. So well done to Iowans for that. I think libraries also bring us together from our different worlds, and I think that's what we've all been drawn to libraries for. So it's very special to be here, and thank you to Peter. There we are. Thank you very much for putting this all together and for the enthusiasm that you showed when we were in the discussion phases almost a year ago, and of course to Claudia, under her leadership, that this is happening. No conflicts of interest, nothing to declare and disclose there. So I come all the way from Johannesburg, It's where I studied, where I worked, but I actually grew up along the coast in a little town called Durban. It's not on the map. But South Africa is at the tip of Africa, just to put that in context. I often get asked, you know, are you from South Africa? And you just happen to come from the southernmost tip. But South Africa is actually a country at the southernmost tip of Africa. And, yeah, so it's 15,300 kilometers away. But I think the point is, and as I've been talking in many of the lectures this week, is that it doesn't matter where we come from, different geographies, different industries, but the exposures in workplaces follow very similar mechanisms, and the disease manifestations always means that there's been a failure in the system somewhere. And I think this morning's lecture at the hospital, we really drove that home, where we emphasized that silicosis is not a failure of medicine, but it's a failure of systems and various points along the systems that result in workers getting silicosis as one of the lung diseases when workers are exposed to silica dust, especially in our deep gold mines. So in South Africa, I just want to say something about the migrant labor system in the South African mines. So mining started in the 1860s. Gold was discovered on the Witwatersrand. And I think with that came the migrant labor system, because we had to now recruit unskilled labor in masses and over short periods of time to start these extensive mining operations that quickly grew into very formalized mining. That started at around 1860. And you'll see on this map that workers came from all these surrounding countries. So it wasn't just from South African rural areas, but from Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, and Swaziland, and less so from the countries to the north of us, but even as far afield as China. So these workers were not just part of the mining community, they were part of the communities back home. So if they got an infectious disease, especially one like TB, which is often associated with silica dust in gold mine workers, they took that TB back home. So the infectious diseases didn't just stay on the mines. They became part of a bigger global health problem. If you can see where these workers came from, and they took those diseases back home. So often these workers were tenured initially for just 9 months. I don't know why. But I think it had something to do with 3 months going home for Christmas, and because they came from so far, it was not worth their while to just go home for a month or so. So it was a 9-month tenure, and in that time, if they got an infectious disease, then off they went. So there's been quite a few papers written by my fellow colleagues on this topic. So migrancy in the mines was part of how labor was organized. So, I think for me, the links and the similarities between the Iowan industry around farming and the meatpacking industry, and the similarities with the mining industry back home, really hit me when I actually visited a prairie city hog farm on Christmas Eve in 2015, so more than 10 years ago. So I hope this video is going to work. Yeah.
Hog confinement in Iowa. All right, no problems, thanks.
Huh? Yeah, great, thank you. So when I walked into this enclosure.
No, that's good.
You see it, you feel it, right? You obviously smell it, the stench, the heat, and the crowding of thousands of these animals. But I think for me it was a combination of, I wasn't sure whether it was actually cold air or hot air, but the stench hits you. It's visually impactful. But I remember thinking that this too is a story about exposure. And there were a few workers moving around. And I thought, you know, whether you as I later learned from Prof. Claudia, that it's called a CAFO, the Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. And, you know, wherever workers are, they are always exposed to some kind of exposure, different settings, but similar patterns of exposure. And these workers, you know, often unseen and faceless and nameless. But it made me think just about the type of exposures here, the bioaerosols, the dry dust, the grain fodder, and you know, the repetitive tasks of the workers who do work in these concentrated animal feeding systems. So these pictures I have to share, because when we walked in, it was a beautiful Christmas Eve. The weather was lovely. It was warm but cold. Hard for me to explain. But when we walked out to snow. And it was just amazing. By the time I got home, we drove back home, it was a whiteout. So it was an incredibly beautiful white Christmas. But also, you know, patterns like this make me think that workers inside at a particular environment can be exposed to particular hazards. But when you walk out, those exposures don't stop. You're actually carrying it home with you, and you're taking it back to your families and into communities. So workers' exposures, again, whether you're in South Africa or here in Iowa City, very similar patterns. Now, my talk today is a series of stories. They may not all intertwine, and I want to move to my next story. So let's talk a bit about women in mining. Now, as I've shared with some colleagues and friends, I'm a hiker. And I always say to my fellow hikers that the first time I actually climbed a mountain was deep underground. Okay? So the South African mines go very deep. I mean, the one I had gone to on my very first visit, I said I want to go to the deepest mine, the hottest place, and the hardest working area, and I got exactly that. But what I didn't have was the appropriate protective equipment. So on that very first visit, it was 1993, women were not allowed underground unless you were going on a visit or you're conducting research or on a special mission where you just go for a few hours in and out. So women were banned from working underground. So when they called me the day before, they said, bring extra socks because you are not going to get boots your size, and bring at least three. I thought they must be crazy, but I took three socks and I wore all three socks so the boots could fit. This is 1993. What was striking then was that there were no change rooms for me. So I had to wait until all the hundreds of men had done their change of clothes, and then I had to go into the men's change room to put on my my overalls, which were far too big, obviously. But fast forward to 2008. This is on my camera, so the date is there. And I was on this visit underground. It was a commissioned visit by the Chamber of Mines back then. And you can see, still all those years later, and this is at a time where women started to go underground, that the safety belt was just too big. Even the overalls were bigger. I remember rolling up the sleeves and rolling up the buttons. But the safety belt was starting to unwind itself. Now, you have to carry on one hip, you're carrying a first aid kit. It's called your rescue box. It's got your basic rescue breathing apparatus and bandages and stuff. And on the other hip, you carry the battery for your headlamp. Now, this belt was getting loose on the visit, so we went underground. And it kept getting loose, and I had to give my it's really quite heavy. It's actually about 2 or 3 kilograms, these rescue kits. I had to give it to my colleague to carry for me, so not the safest of conditions. But these are the conditions that we had to work under. And then fast forward to very recently, in 2020, I took a group of students underground. And you can see, extremely well kitted out. I even have elbow guards and knee guards and even a head duk. We call this a duk, and you put your hard hat or the helmet over that. So extremely well kitted out more recently. But that came with its challenges. It didn't come without a fight, without a lot of advocacy from women who wanted to work in these jobs that were predominantly saved for men. And it didn't happen automatically. You know, women had to fight for this. When women went underground, there were no toilets underground because men could do it anywhere. But the women couldn't. And they fought to have toilets underground. But those toilets were a long distance to walk to. So the men underground used to have issues with that because the women are taking too long to take a break and get to the toilet and get back to their working area. So huge, huge issues. But I think the point I want to raise is that I think the greatest risks in the workplace, it's not just the environment, But it's these environments that we create with these risks, and we expect people to work in them, knowing that there are risks there. And then we don't do well enough to control those risks. And that's why we still have diseases today. So I think the lessons that we've learned along the way in mining can easily be replicated in other high-risk industries as well. Now we move to TB and HIV story. So this is a TB sanitarium for mine workers who are suffering from tuberculosis. This morning we got asked at the lecture, what is TB? It's tuberculosis. It's an infectious disease, usually associated with suppressed immune systems. But in mining, there's a higher risk for TB because of the dust exposure. So silica dust actually increases the risk of getting TB. So TB is an occupational lung disease in our South African mines, and it's more dominant in the gold mines because of the high silica content in the gold ore body. So this sanitarium, which is in the east of Johannesburg, was built for mine workers who had TB. I mean, they were just confined and isolated in these sanitariums until they were cured. So 6 months, usually 6 to 8 months or longer, depends on what type of TB you have. You'll be confined to the sanitarium, not allowed to see your friends or family. Well, family were far anyway. So what was then one of the first initiatives around health, which was quite something in the mines. Remember, the mines predominantly focus on, most high-risk industries, focus on safety. Very little attention is given to health, and it's something we've had to also fight for and advocate for as medical people on the mines. So it isolated workers, and it clearly was not the ideal system. So they were sent there, out of sight, out of mind, but it was one of the earliest systems designed to respond to the occupational diseases. Now, when I got to the mines in the mid-1990s, the medical wards and our TB wards, we had special TB wards because it was an infectious disease. Most of the patients in those wards, and those wards were about 200 together in a 300-bed hospital, most of the patients were in the medical wards and not surgical. And most of them were HIV positive. Okay, now think about it. These were young, black, mainly black migrant men and living in single-sex hostels. And in the absence of antiretroviral drugs, they were severely immune-suppressed, exposed to a high burden of silica dust that was also promoting TB. So the TB epidemic in South Africa, and we've had the highest rates in the world, especially in the gold mines, was driven largely by the HIV epidemic without antiretroviral treatment and the silica dust. And that's something we're not proud of, but something we hold the world record for, if I may say. So at that time, I think it was a huge challenge as a young doctor treating these patients, but without the optimal treatment. And yet, you know, these drugs were available in the rest of the world, but there were huge political issues in the country that prevented the access to these drugs. And it was quite tragic because these were men, you know, often on a call you'd get summoned by the nurse to come and, you know, certify a patient. And most cases, they were dying from respiratory illnesses at the time. So I think across, again, you know, to draw the parallels, across the decades and across these diseases, the patterns are the same, and we just see different versions of exposures and different versions of manifestations of disease of these workers in different parts of the world. But there's something that's not often seen, and I want to share this with you. I'm managing two screens here. So, at this conference, which was in West Virginia, it's a pipe stem conference, beautiful part of the United States, and the researcher posed this question to the corporate director for safety and health at one of the largest mining companies in North America, and the question was simple: does your company, or do you know of other companies who have any programs or systems in place to support miners who witness or experience occupational trauma? So it was directed at, do you offer psychological help or support to your workers? And his answer was a very straight I don't know of any. And Drew Harris and colleagues went on to write the paper where they looked at 2,800 mine workers, active and former workers who are seen at the black lung clinics. And these clinics are put into place by NIOSH. So it's the NIOSH coal workers surveillance programs where these workers who are current or former can attend. So these workers were obviously carrying a burden of disease. Most of them, 96%, had a dust disease due to the coal mine dust. But what was clear from the study was that more than one-third suffered from depression. So they used a mental health scale to assess these workers. And of those who had depression, 1 in 10 had suicidal ideations. And there were high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in this group of workers who had dust disease from the coal mines. And these trends were significantly higher than what was seen in the general population. So if you ask me what's the prevalence of mental health conditions in mine workers, sorry, OLDs is an abbreviation, an acronym we use, it's occupational lung diseases, I don't know. I don't think it's been sufficiently researched. So the diseases we do not see are as important, especially when they're arising from these preventable occupational diseases. And it's something I think we all should be aware of and clearly research more. So workers die. Workers die because of these occupational exposures. Annually, we see about 2 million deaths per year from work-related diseases and injuries. But here's the important thing is that of these, 80 to 85% are due to diseases. Now, if we go back in time, 40 to 50 years ago, the large majority would have been from accidents in the mining industry. But that trend has now turned, and it's diseases. So of these diseases, the occupational lung diseases feature the most strongly. It's the leading contributor. So if a worker is dying from an occupational disease, the chances are quite high that it's going to be from a lung disease. And the other problem is that these lung diseases, they contribute disproportionately because they are irreversible. Once that inflammatory process starts in your lungs because of these dusts and other hazardous agents in a mining environment, it's totally irreversible. It's incurable. Okay? And the progression is it's chronic. And then we have also interaction with smoking and with TB to compound the effects of the occupational diseases. So it's a huge burden on society to have an occupational disease. But, dear friends and colleagues, these workers still come back. They will go home with their disease, and they will come back, and as we were discussing now, they will send their family members to work in these same environments as well. Now, my occupational health clinic on the mines was situated inside the single-sex hostels. And when it was Christmas or it's the Easter break and they're all going home and these buses line up in droves and block my way, so I couldn't get home sometimes. I'd have to call the hostel manager to come, please move the truck so I can get home. When I was visiting in Prairie City, I was asked to address the congregation on what was the topic? Now it was what does it feel like to be a mine worker in South Africa at Christmas? I'm not giving you the exact title, but it was something along those lines. And it made me think deeply about the difference between what I was experiencing here in Iowa and how I experienced those mine workers going home in droves. And often, you know, there's no gifts here. You know, these are the structures to go back, go back and build their homes. Here's a water tank. And this was not an uncommon scene. And of course, to be received by the joy of family is what gave these workers purpose. Now, in South Africa, it's known that every mine worker will most likely have about 10 dependents, family or friend in the community, who are dependent on his or her salary. So when we talk about dust and disease and dignity of labor, I think that these the fact that these mine workers still keep coming back is dignity of labor for them, because they have pride in what they do, because they are providing for their families. And that's where the dignity and the resilience of these workers came from. And I saw it time and time again. You know, you think after a severe injury and you have a disability of your arm, but you're still able to do other jobs on the mine, you'd wonder how they still keep coming back. But it's because of these family members and the communities back who are so dependent on these workers. I hope I'm doing okay for time. I've got just two slides left, and then we'll be done. So over the last day or two, we've been talking a lot about the iceberg and what we see and what we hear and the numbers. The 2 million deaths per year are the ones we know, are the workers that present into a system and are counted, the ones we see. And beneath the iceberg, there's a massive burden that we clearly do not see, whether it's deaths or disability, especially disability. I think we really undercount disability. And that's because these workers often may choose to go home once they have their disease. Others will choose to stay if they are offered a job. The current economic situation is these workers often do not have, they are not able to be reaccommodated in the workplace, especially in mining, because they have a very specific skill, and if they cannot do their job underground, most likely, if you're diagnosed with one of these lung diseases, so you'll end up going home. So the real burden, we actually do not know. There's a huge invisible burden. So I just want to leave you with this. Has anyone here been anywhere deep underground? In a tunnel, maybe? Peter? Yes? Ah, lovely. Any experiences to share?
Just really cold and dark and very scary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Thanks for sharing.
You get it if you're claustrophobic at all. You will definitely have those sensations.
Yeah. Thank you, Russ. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So, I think, you know, when you think of these mine workers in these sometimes cold environments, sometimes it's extremely hot. Actually, when you walk into the mine, it's very cold because they've got the ventilation going. You actually need a jacket or two. But once you get to a working, we call it a stope, a working area like this, it can get very hot and very dark, very poor illumination. But yet, you know, you have to work. So I think if you all can just imagine what this might be like and to think about these workers in their challenging conditions who still come back, still work, still provide, and they still endure. And for them, that is dignity of labor. And the resilience that they show, I don't think it's something that many of us in this room can actually identify with. So on that note, I'm going to stop there. And thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. So attentively, and I think together we have a lot that we can do. We can build these resilient, defensible occupational health systems together. In South Africa, we talk about Ubuntu. Ubuntu means I am because we are, and I think these problems are multidisciplinary. Medicine is not going to solve it. Science is not going to solve it. But we need engineers, we need the exposure scientists, industrial hygienists working very closely together with psychologists, behavioral scientists to really support workers in these very challenging conditions. So on that note, thank you very much. Thank you.
Excellent. So Vanessa, do you want to have a seat and relax with us here?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
We'd love to relax with you.
Okay, good. So now we have the panel portion of our program today. And so we absolutely welcome interruptions and questions and free association, experiences, stories, anything that you out there want to share with us and with each other. But to start, I'm going to ask a question of our panelists, and I have lots of questions prepared, but I'm really think this would be best if we just all free associate a bit. So This is sort of a high-level question to kind of get the conversation started for Naomi. And Dr. Bedell, may I call you David?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Of course.
And David. So Naomi and David, to ask, are there any points or issues that Vanessa brought up that resound in specifically for you? Do you see any connections to your own work, to the patients that you treat and see, common issues? Have you made any notes about anything that you think, you want to mention, you want to talk about? So this is sort of a high level question, very open-ended.
So on one level, a lot of migrant workers and their families, it's a disruption of family. And even, say, the people that work at West Liberty Foods or at Tyson, they work often long hours, 10, 12 hours, so they get home late, and then have to work 6 days a week or 7 days a week, depending on what the stock of turkeys or pork is. And this doesn't lead to having the worker having time to support their children and so forth. And I think that, the mine workers, move away from home and are away for long periods of time. The migrant workers that do the detasseling and so forth are away for 6 to 10 months. And away, some of them bring their families, but if you bring your families, you're sort of dependent on your employer to provide housing, which often is suboptimal. Here in the States, the people that work in the meatpacking industry, about 45% have incomes less than 200% of the poverty level, and 12% below the poverty line. And these are people that are working long hours.
Yeah, to echo your point, Vanessa said about migrant workers moving away for like 9 months at a time, and all I could think about is that still is going on today. It's very relevant today. A lot of the migrant workers I work with every day, they leave their families for 9, 10 months at a time. Some may be lucky and only come for 2 months, but some are here most of the year. And you pointed it out in your presentations, but it's their families that keep them going. And that's the reason why they keep coming back, is they know the money they make here in the States, when you translate it into pesos in Mexico, for example, it can sustain them for so long, and it gives their kids a really good education, their housing, we have patients here that they're here for so long, but they say it's worth it, and it's fine coming back despite the conditions they're living in, the conditions they're working in, because for them, they just want to get their family ahead.
I might add to Naomi's point, and to everybody's points, really, in the dignity of work, and at least for the farm workers coming to Iowa, to the migrant farm workers and the seasonal workers. They leave their family, they come to Iowa, they're here and very driven to work those long hours in the heat and the sun for exactly the reasons that Naomi mentioned. During the pandemic, this was actually a bit of a problem because we had farm workers come during those pandemic summers. And one of the ways that we were protecting people from COVID were taking temperatures, reporting a cough, letting people know that they weren't feeling well so that we could then quarantine them or isolate them to prevent infection from spreading. And those measures of self-report of symptoms and screening weren't working very well because people didn't want to self-report. They were coming to Iowa for one reason and one reason only, and that was to make money and send it to their families and leave. So they didn't want to be set aside in the trailer and not be able to work. And it really posed some real problems before we had vaccines and before we had measures other than social distancing and self-reporting of symptoms. So that was sort of a turn on the table, that sort of drive to work actually became a little bit difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Proteus, by the way, that Naomi works for, led the essentially the entire mitigation and response to COVID in Iowa. It's a very small organization, really took care of nearly all of the sick farm workers, managed all the isolation, all the quarantine, delivered nearly all of the vaccines. It was an enormous effort put forth by a very small staff.
And the meatpacking industry was one of the hardest hit because they were, quote, essential workers, and they're packed in together, and it's like a conveyor belt, so everybody's close to each other. And they had some of the highest rates of COVID early on in 2020, and then quite a few deaths, and then they would, of course, take it home to their families. So, and part of it, I think, is over the last couple decades, OSHA has been weakened, because if we have occupational safety, that's going to decrease from profits. It's going to increase the cost of things, is the argument. And so so that, to a certain extent, has been abandoned, and there aren't as many inspections, or there aren't enough people working for OSHA to do the job that needs to be done.
It's very true. Vanessa, what was your experience with the miners during COVID?
So, yeah, thanks. Actually, on the back of what you've mentioned, Claudia, I think with the mining industry, COVID had a positive effect. That's just my view. Because I think for the first time, we saw workers really understanding what respiratory medical surveillance was all about. And it was after that that people who were working underground started demanding respirators and dust masks. So it created such a heightened awareness. But the other point around COVID in the mining industry was how occupational medicine suddenly became the much-loved discipline because we knew how to manage disaster situations. We knew how to do a risk assessment. We knew how to stratify workers. That the other health and safety professionals were not as familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I think it really raised the profile of occupational medicine. And in many ways, I think that has now infiltrated other industries, but I think still there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in keeping occupational medicine on the profile, on a high profile, and in terms of workers understanding why they need this type of surveillance.
And industry, employers, government understanding occupational medicine. So as a rehabilitated surgeon and now occupational medicine doc, it's amazing to me that people don't know what occupational medicine is. Because if we work age 18 to 65, 40 hours a week, we spend over 90,000 hours at work. So to think that, you know, there's so little known and so in sort of the public domain concern about occupational wellness. And I have lots of other things to say, but anything else for the panel?
Well, you know, I have a biased view as a primary care physician because the patients that I see are the ones that haven't gotten what they wanted from the occupation, you know. And one of the disadvantages here in the United States is a lot of the workers view the occupational medicine as working for the employer. Mm-hmm. And they're not really backing up the patient. It's sort of let's keep the cost down. That's the view that often comes out. And it makes care complicated that we have this fragmented system because, you know, what can, you know, will their insurance pay for it? Blue Cross will say, no, that's an occupational thing. I'm not going to cover it. And so then the patient, if they come and see me, can be stuck with the cost of that visit. It's the same with automobile insurance. You know, we've got these multiple systems that don't integrate very well.
Thank you for that. This very complicated construct between the patient, the company, and the insurance company, which is, an entire course of study. Naomi, I have a question for you. What about some of the health and social infrastructure that Proteus, some of the sort of sustenance support that Proteus is able to provide for the workers? How does that play in? Like your mobile clinics and some of the other sort of adjacent services that Proteus provides?
Yeah, so kind of like what I mentioned before, we do mobile clinics throughout the state. We actually got two new mobile unit vans, so we can start doing like really cool stuff. But historically and even today, how we kind of go about that is we work closely with employers. In a way, thanks to COVID, we were able to get more meaningful, more, I think it was where employers actually started to begin to trust us being in their space. But our mobile clinics will, for different companies, if they let us on site, we'll just set up wherever. Dr. Corin knows, we set up in cafeterias, in warehouses, in laundry rooms, wherever we can get a space, we'll set up. So now that we have mobile units supposed to help with that barrier, we can't find a space. During COVID, we were in the parks. We find community centers. Just anywhere we can be, we'll be there. What we do is preventative care or primary care. So we do a lot of like wellness exams, and we manage a lot of chronic illness. So we see a lot of patients that have diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and then just acute things, like if they might have like headaches, muscle aches, or they might think they have an infection, such as, we help with that as well. And our mobile clinics, we just try to mirror any type of any clinic if you were to go to the hospital. So like the check-in person, vitals and labs. We do both finger poke labs and phlebotomy labs, which is really nice because we can get an A1C right there and then and help with that. And by helping with that too, we have an on-site pharmacy that we have in our offices, but we also take with us to our clinics. And that's just to help help patients get the medications right there and then versus having to send it out to a pharmacy where they may or may not go pick it up, especially if they have lack transportation. Within our providers, if our providers don't speak Spanish, we're always there to help interpret. Our main languages are English and Spanish. However, we do have a language line that we pay for as well if there ever is a need for that. So that kind of is the gist of like the mobile clinics. But then we also do Proteus as a whole, also does other things. Like we have people who do heat stress training, pesticides training, especially during the summertime with those farm workers. We just remind them how important it is to protect themselves as well. Jobs training. And then there's the other side, the whole other side of Proteus does education assistance. They can help farm workers obtain like their GED, or if they want to get into welding or stuff like that, like kind of like advance their career, they can help with that, with like tuition assistance and all that kind of stuff as well.
And just a bit about how you accommodate worker schedules and, you know, the specifics of being a farm worker and access to care.
Yeah, so a lot of our migrant workers, kind of like what Dr. Corin said, they're here to work. Like, that's their mission. Like, they're not here to see us, and we want to respect that. So how we actually go about is we actually have most of our clinics at the night between, like, 6 to 10 p.m., sometimes later, just because we know we want to accommodate to their schedule because they're not going to leave their middle of their workday to come see us. But we also push them to, you know, take care of their own health. And so we try to accommodate in that sense. I think just 1-3 times a week for a couple of months it's nothing compared to like the work they're doing. We even provide like over-the-counter medications because there's a lot of patients with the lack of transportation, especially if they're bused up here from like Mexico, they can't even make it to Walmart. Like for us, it's a quick drive, but for them, they might go once a week if they're not working the 7 days a week.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any comments from the panel? Anything else for now?
I think the whole concept of the mobile clinic is one that makes healthcare for these workers more accessible. And it's also a concept that's well used in South Africa, particularly for the ex-mine workers. I have not spoken much about ex-mine workers. So when mine workers are exposed to dust, they should be in a lifelong medical surveillance because the diseases manifest long after they leave the mine. there's a long what we call a latency. So from the time of first exposure to when they get a disease can be anything from 20 to 30 to even 40 years later. Mm-hmm. So one mechanism to enable access for these mine workers after they leave the mines is to have mobile units going out, and they are very sophisticated outreach programs that are set up by the Department of Health and some of the big mining companies who do these outreach programs, track and trace these mine workers, conduct the chest x-rays and the lung function testing where they live. But still quite a challenge because these workers live in deep rural areas and they still have to travel long distances to get to the mobile unit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's one mechanism.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's discouraging is that how disempowered the farm workers are. 80% of the farm workers in Iowa are with an H-2A visa, which basically they have to do everything that the employer wants. The employer provides them health care, supposedly. They provide them food. But if they don't show up at work, then the employer can send them back to their country of origin. There's no political organization, or it's very difficult to have any political organization from those farm workers. And then when you look at the meatpacking industry, 80% are people of color. 71% are non-citizens. And about 37% are foreign-born. So, and when you think about back to the 70s, there's been a huge transition because in the 70s, a lot of the meatpacking industry was in big cities like Chicago and so forth, and they've been moved to rural areas. You could argue that it's because it's closer to where the product is being produced, but it also means you get a very different population taking care of it. And then when you look at the young workers under 16, 90% of them are Hispanic. So, whereas there's some people with gray hair out there that probably remember detasseling as a thing that almost all teenagers in rural areas went through, now only about 20% of the detasseling is done by native citizens here in Iowa. 80% is done by farm workers that are brought in from outside the country.
Thank you. Mental health. If you might don't mind, Naomi, so Proteus does a mental health screening for all of its patients. And Naomi and I and a few other colleagues did a bunch of studies. But one study had to do with, looked at mental health in farm workers, migrant farm workers. And we found that despite what is written, that there's tremendous stigma and that people don't want to self-report about anxiety and depression, that farm workers were very willing to, this group of farm workers that we sampled, can't be sure it's representative of others, very willing to report their depression and their anxiety. So Naomi, David, Vanessa, what are you seeing out there with your patients with respect to mental health disease, willingness to discuss, stigma, trends? Let's open it up.
You know, this reminds me of the days, again, back of in the 1990s when we were treating all these HIV-positive workers with no ARVs. And I had to do a research study for my studies towards occupational medicine. So I looked at stress in the nurses who were working with these HIV patients. And the one thing that stood out was that they did not have support structures, not for the patients, but for themselves, because they were not coping with caring for workers who were inevitably going to die. I mean, these workers were on their deathbed. And I don't think the enormity of the problem had hit us. These days, fast forward about 30 years later, there are much better support structures, both for workers in terms of employee assistance programs, where there's 24/7 dial-in confidential support and referrals into face-to-face consultations if needed. So the employee assistance programs, I think, have really transformed how we respond to mental health conditions. But still, I think, the stigma is there. And as you mentioned, self-reporting will always be an issue because of the stigma. But it's up to all of us, I think, to raise the awareness around these issues and to, you know, help and support these workers. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I think after having established rapport with patients, they're very willing to talk openly about it. I think there is still a thought that I should take care of it naturally and not take medication. But that's true also with hypertension and lots of conditions. But it's, you know, I think it's much better than it was 25, 30 years ago in terms of people's willingness to acknowledge stress. The other thing that I find is like with people that have significant injuries, you know, they come to me and they ask, can you write a note for my work saying that I can't do this and this and this? And then a week later, they come back and say, well, can you say that I can do that? Because they won't let me work if I can't do that. You know, because in work, if the injury happened on the job, then they want you back right away, and they'll find light duty. If it happened outside the job, then you have to be fully ready to return before most places will take you back. And so there's a discrepancy. The same injury gets treated differently depending on where the injury occurred.
Yeah, my experience, I think, definitely the rapport. I think when you grow rapport with patients, they're more willing to talk to you or report what they're feeling. I think I see within a lot more women than men that they'll talk about more what they're feeling, but... Yeah, and then I think it's very interesting because they'll admit, you know, they have feelings of anxiety, depression. We see a lot of that, especially when migrant workers, they leave their families for so long, they start to feel it after a while that they want to go back home. But a lot of them also, when we offer them medication, they're like, nope, it's okay. Like, you know, I find my own way. Or I see this a lot when I do, like, the PHQ screenings. They're like, you know, I am depressed, but, like, I make sure I make myself busy. Otherwise, like, I'm going to get more depressed if I don't keep working or if I don't, you know, clean around the house or whatever it might be. Yeah, to David's point, also, there's a lot of patients who might get notes and they have, like, presented to work and they don't want to be on light duty. A couple years ago, I had a patient who she had a mastectomy. And she was like, I can't be depressed. It's going to make me sad. Like, I need to work. But then her surgeon wouldn't let her work. And she was just trying to find every way possible to work, even when her employer was saying it's okay to rest. And I think I see that a lot, especially with, like, older workers, that they're just used to always working. They don't know how to give a break to themselves. So I think that's another thing we see as well. A lot of stress.
Thank you for that. I think just to sort of edit myself, in this group that we surveyed, they were all Proteus patients, and that this group that was quite forthcoming about depression and anxiety. And I'm not so sure it is actually representative of all farm workers, obviously, because Proteus is actually an organization that's been going since the 1970s at least, and it's really a trusted entity by the farm workers. Some of these workers come back year after year after year. Their children come back and work on the farms. And so Proteus is a trusted entity. We were working with Proteus, so it might be that they felt particularly comfortable sort of being forthcoming about how they were feeling. So at this point, unless the panel has anything you want to add in right now, I think we should open it up to questions and see if people have questions, or it could just be a comment or a thought, anything.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Doctor, could you speak on the types of chronic illnesses or what happened, what you see as far as physical illnesses of the people in the meatpacking and also in the field work? Obviously, you're working too many hours, so there's going to be plenty of workplace accidents.
Right.
But I mean, as far as chronic diseases or other things.
Yeah. Well, in the meatpacking industry, the most common thing is, of course, repetitive in-use injuries. So it's musculoskeletal problems. There's also quite a few falls because there's climbing ladders and getting in awkward positions. I guess one of my badges of pride is that Tyson, I used to always take the residents to see what the occupational risks were. And then one year they didn't respond to my request, and I called some of the people I knew there, and they said, well, the central office doesn't want you to come because I'd done depositions for some of their workers. And so I was on their blacklist, the no-fly list at Tyson.
I'm just going to insert myself really quick. My dad used to work at Tyson for like the first 15 years when we first moved to Iowa. And like, I'm actually from Storm Lake, Iowa. I don't know if anyone has heard of that little town.
Yep.
But we have a lot, like the majority of people working at Tyson, they're from the different nationalities and countries. And I think, just to David's point, a lot of musculoskeletal. I think they have a lot of untreated also, like diabetes and hypertension as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of diabetes, hypertension.
There's also just, like, freak accidents sometimes. Like, last year or the year before, I had a patient. He was in the field, and he got hit by a deer.
Yeah.
Like, literally, the deer, like, they both scared each other, and the deer just, like, rammed into him.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, went flying through the air, like.
Multiple injuries,
everything. Yeah, so there's also just, like, freak mm-hmm. accidents that happen as well.
For the repetitive injury, so imagine if you're standing on the line, and I have a video, but not here. And imagine if you're standing on the line, and you have a line of chickens going by you, and your job is to make one very specific slice in that chicken or that turkey. So you're standing, you have a gown on, you have a shield on, your eye protection. On your left hand, you have a mesh glove to prevent yourself from cutting yourself. On your right hand, you have another glove. And what you do for at least 8 hours a day is you do this. So what's the chance that you're going to end up with a shoulder injury, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I was at OSHA, I was at OSHA for a little while, they brought the attorneys at OSHA, consulted with the doctors, and said the poultry industry wants to speed up the lines. And they wanted our take on what this would mean with respect to occupational health and the workers. And the reason that they wanted, well, the lobby, not the attorneys, the lobby, the poultry lobby, wanted to speed up the lines because they said the faster the lines go, the less risk of contamination to that poultry and the less risk to the consumer because it's going to get wrapped up quicker. And there was very, very little concern or consideration given to those people standing on the line doing this constantly, already too fast. So there is this tension between industry and occupational health and safety.
Okay.
That is
and lacerations, of course, would be.
I say my dad got his finger.
And then, you know, in the hog, you know, Tyson here in Columbus Junction, it's hog. And so there's a process of burning the skin off and so forth. And so there, people do get burns, too.
The follow-up I had to that was obviously we know that people come because they want to make the money to take care of their families, and you said it's able to improve their life back home. But from what you've observed, because I wanted to know what some of the injuries were, what you've observed, there's really nobody, I mean, kind of putting this bluntly, there's nobody that makes public policy that really cares what's happening as far as these injuries and the unsafe conditions and the number of hours that they're working. Would you agree with that?
Sorry, really quick. I guess I know I'm going to talk from, like, so people come on the H-2A visa. That's, like, the special visa. Employers are required by law to provide housing. There's another organization called Iowa Works Development, IWD. They have, like, housing inspections to go check off these housings, but it hasn't been updated since, I believe, like, the 70s. So even though those have not been updated, so they get checked off or they get, like, approved every year. One of the places we go to, it looks like a big warehouse, and it's just, like, bunk bed after bunk bed after bunk bed after, you know, and there's, like, two big fans at the very ends, and they, even the workers themselves, they call it gallinero, which, like, translate to English, like, chicken coop. Nice. Nice. And, you know, when I've asked the employer, you know, why they haven't, because, you know, employers also, the workers themselves always complain, and whenever I've asked, like, do you want me to bring it up, they're like, no, because then they won't hire me back next year. And I think there was one time we were doing a tour, and I think the employer himself said, well, they're only here for a couple weeks, so, like, it's okay, you know, and it's, like, it's very disencouraging, or I don't know, it's just, like, very just, like, so frustrating to see, you know, and it's, like, also hear from the workers, but also respecting that they don't want us to say anything, and even though there's Iowa Legal Aid and, you know, they could report anything they wanted to, like, they're scared to. So, like, that's, like, what the balance that's really hard to see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, hello. Okay. Well, I mean, great presentation, by the way. I'm from Texas, just so if I ask something that goes off track, that's why. I'm thinking as you are speaking about the players, and you kind of someone touched on the idea of who's actually there for the workers, right? So you have the worker, the employer, the consumer, for people that like baking, you know, and the government, the, you know, policymakers and people that are regulators, right? Perhaps you have other players, but those are major players in this matrix. And the healthcare providers, right? So at some point, you have to begin to wonder who's supposed to be doing what that's not doing it, right? So another way to think through this is if there would be a better scenario, if we consider any of those things you've said as bad or wrong or not ideal, what would that better scenario be? And who has to do what to make it happen? Right? So that's just, I don't know if it's a question or if it's a Texas comment, mm-hmm. but I think that's, and I would just say this and I'll stop, right? So everybody's complaining about the price of X, make it anything, right? And if tomorrow you go to the store and it's times two that price, how would you feel as a consumer? But it's times two that price because the employer has to provide not Marriott style, but a better living condition, right? Which is definitely needed. So don't think I'm saying, oh, no, the coop. How would I react as a consumer? Maybe I need to know. Maybe we need ads. Instead of seeing ads for bakings, I need to see ads that say, workers are doing this every time, you know, it's wrong, right? But the consumer probably the average consumer probably doesn't know what it means to get that bacon for 50 cents, right? So anyhow, so I go back to my matrix. Mm-hmm. Who needs to do what for a better scenario to happen? Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for that question. I think that's the whole point. Because when we talk occupational medicine and we look at all these different role players, we look at legislative frameworks, policies that are in place, regulations that are in place, we're talking about compliance. But yet, in many ways, we need to really, really lift and uplift workers in terms of health and wellness and safety. It goes beyond compliance. Compliance actually should be just the minimum standard that we all comply to. We all should be law-abiding. But in health, we've realized more and more that meeting the minimum standard is not going to achieve the ideals that we want in terms of, if you think of total worker health, and if you think of future fit and how we'd like our workers to function in the modern society. But the point around the players and who does what, the accountability for health and safety must sit squarely in the different legs of the system. So the system, if you look at it, is underpinned by legislation and regulations. But there are different role players. For example, if you think of a worker who's exposed to dust underground, right? The scenario that I was trying to paint. Clearly, dust control sits with engineers. They have to engineer out the hazard at its source, ideally. You've got to eliminate that emission in the first instance as best they can. And if they cannot, then there are other levels in that hierarchy of control where there's industrial hygienists, there's behavioral scientists who all have a role to play. So the role of the occupational medicine doctors, yes, we have a role to play in terms of the medical surveillance to monitor for the effects when things are not in control, when the hazards are not being controlled. So I had a worked with a very good occupational, we call them occupational hygienists, here they call industrial hygienists, but I worked with an excellent one, many of them in South Africa. But this particular colleague always said to me, Dr. Govender, if I'm doing my job properly and I'm controlling all the hazards at the workplace, you will not have work to do. So that's something that stuck in my mind, and I know that to do my job well, I've got to work very closely with the industrial hygienists and for the data and the feedback and the results of our work to go back into the system, back to the engineers and the hygienists to control the workplace hazards more. So who's accountable? It's very clear, but there are often gray areas, and there are often times where we are so busy. You're busy seeing patients, and you forget about, these feedback loops. So you have to plan for it. You have to structure it in your systems and the programs at the workplace to make sure that there's this continuous feedback. And then, of course, there's accountability that sits at a very high level, which is the legislative level. But, over these last few days, we've been sharing the Australian story as a very good example of advocacy in action, where these workers, they realized there was a surge of the accelerated form of silicosis in countertop workers. So your engineered stone, the granite stone tops that you have in your bathrooms and kitchens, and they're beautiful. But when they do dry cutting, they're exposed to very high levels. It's up to 90% or more even of silica in those countertops. Anyway, long story short, they realized there was a surge. And in Western Australia, they undertook a survey to use high-resolution CT scan to see if we were missing cases. They were missing cases of silicosis in workers who are only having chest X-rays, the regular chest X-rays done, and they picked up that, almost one in two workers were undiagnosed. And then they went fast forward, and they changed the regulations. Within 6 years, you saw the banning of the engineered stone industry in Australia. So whose job is that? I mean, there we saw the regulator, the engineers, the radiologists, and the occupational medicine physicians together with primary care physicians working together. And I think that's the kind of advocacy, that's the kind of multidisciplinary work that we need to do to really show accountability and to make a difference. Thank you.
So first of all, thank you so much. This has been an excellent conversation. I'd like to put in another layer to the onion that I've been thinking about as you all have been talking. Morals, ethics. And I wonder the extent to which all of us, maybe call us the consumers in this larger equation, the extent to which we are all complicit. Mm-hmm. And the degree to which the rationalization of that idea, of that reality, is maybe too much for, you know, our human brains to comprehend, right? Like, we have to get through our own days. We have our own challenges. This is one of those global challenges that the people face around the world. And so, yes, it is a challenge. It is a terrible thing. But I wonder how you all, you know, think about that layer of it. Because we know that when a significant change needs to happen in a country, let's say, taking, for example, what happened recently in Hungary, right, where the populace says, enough of this. The corruption is too much. The poverty is too much. So we make a change at the national level. Right? It takes a lot of people to pull that off. But what you're describing is, in many ways, much bigger and truly global. So I'm wondering how, as medical professionals, how you think about this layer of the onion, the one that none of us really want to engage with ourselves in our, you know, the quiet moments in our heads, and the extent to which we are all complicit.
You know, if you're talking about like medical or health professionals and ethics, I think it's within the purview of medical professionals or health professionals to feel a responsibility to be advocates in one way or the other. And there are like just trillions of ways any person can decide to take on advocacy. It could be advocacy for worker health, and you know, when our kids are upset that the Amazon box didn't come at 8 in the morning, you could remind them that those Amazon workers were working at 3 in the morning to pick your boxes that do arrive at 8 in the morning. So I think it's difficult to address any, like, specifically any particular issue, to be honest. It's hard to wrap your mind around how to address something and make something effective or make a difference. But if every health professional or every citizen said, okay, I'm going to be an advocate for one thing, one tiny thing. It's like Atomic Habits, if anyone's read that book by James Clear. One tiny decision, one tiny cause, it can be really small. But if everybody can adapt sort of a mind frame or a mindset of becoming an advocate, then maybe, you know, the needles can be moved. Maybe this mindset can be taught in school with young people, really young people. And I know kindness and responsibility and everything is taught in kindergarten and first grade, but maybe there are things that can be done in terms of education, taking personal responsibility for one small bit of the pie, one small piece of life or one's experience to advocate for. It's almost like an existential question, right? But unless we think about and grapple with these really existential questions, we'll never move the needle. So I think as many times as we can to receive those kinds of questions, that's really important. I appreciate your asking.
Can I just add to the back of that, Claudia? I think those were great points you made to a very existential question. But thanks for the question, Peter. It reminds me that in occupational medicine, one of our key roles is to be the worker's advocate. So yes, we are there to diagnose, but at the same time, I think we are the one medical profession that has to keep asking the key question is, what caused this? So when you attend your primary care physician for a cough or a cold, that doctor does not necessarily have to ask, what causes. You get treated and off you go. But in occupational medicine, the reason we look for causality is so we can go back, and that's applying an ethical, a very ethical mindset to the work we do, because we want to prevent those cases from happening in the first place. And there is a great, you know, we have a fantastic code of ethics that we adhere to in occupational medicine. And I was listening to the challenges that you have with the insurer and Dr. Bedell, and I think that's where we have to wear a different hat. So each time you see a worker, today it might be just assessing the condition, determining whether this is work-related, but tomorrow it might be a compensation issue, or it might be the worker wants to go back to work, so it's a fitness to work issue. But at all times, you are there primarily for the patient. Yes, you might be representing the employer too, but you're wearing these various hats, and I think that's something that we are trained to do, and we have to do it skillfully, ethically, and professionally, and using the best science and knowledge that we have at a particular point in time. So that's a great question. I don't think there's a straightforward answer to it, but I hope that somewhat addresses your question. Thank you.
Yeah,
just to echo really quick, I think I have thought that way for so long, especially with everything going on in the world, and it's so hard not to think about everything. But so I think about, like, what can I control? And, like, I know that's, like, my advocacy with, like, immigrants or just the farm worker population. Not only, like, sure on social media or, like, being present at the place, but also in, like, the workplace. Like, even with my leadership or with the state level or, like, you know, whatever I can do and just advocate for patients. I'm not a provider or anything like that. I'm nothing like special like that. But I try to take my privilege of, you know, I think I recognize my privilege a lot of, like, I was born in the United States. I speak English and Spanish. I'm a citizen, like, and, you know, I went to school and all this stuff. So I just think about, like, how to use my privilege to help others. And I think that's kind of like what centers me a lot and why I advocate, I think, for everybody else, because I recognize my privilege and I want to use it.
One other thing that I would quickly say is that we need to somehow learn to recognize the assumptions in our thinking and question the consequences of those assumptions. Because there's many things that we take for granted, you know, and, you know, having probably a liberal bias, I think, you know, sort of the monetization of everything leads to certain, decisions which may not actually be very good for our society. And then, you know, you have to look at, like in Iowa, we have this great law that says that, any bill or appropriation should have a health impact assessment done before it's passed. How often do we hear about that happening with anything that's done? How often has that influenced the state legislature and what they're doing? I can't think of an example myself. You know, but it would be great if we took that rule seriously and tried to apply it.
Last question. So I totally agree that consumers are influencing the situation that we have now. I mean, absolutely. But the big problem is our economic system. And consumers or workers individually have virtually no impact on that. It's going to be only through large organized efforts along with legislation and voting that we make any kind of an impact from the top down. Not a question. Just a
So as we end tonight, thank you all for coming. Remember on Thursday, May 7th at The Englert, a special presentation on oligarchy and as a threat to democracy. It'll be our end of our program. It'll be excellent. Please make every consideration to attend with us. Before we end tonight, I'd like to thank our wonderful panel for their efforts tonight. Thank you.